Hey everyone, I have a question. Are you listening to this episode on Himalaya? If you are, awesome, because you're already using the best new podcast app out there. If you're not, you're missing out. Not only does Himalaya have a ton of cool features like curated podcast lists and collections, along with personalized recommendations, but our new members-only version of The Professor Is In podcast is only available on the Himalaya app. So be sure and download it, check it out, and keep an eye out for our members-only content. Hi, and welcome to The Professor Is In podcast. I am Kel Weinhold.
And I am Dr. Karen Kelski, and we are very happy to have you here again today.
Today, we are going to be talking about the adjunct zone.
Yes. That's the ominous, cue the ominous music.
That's the only witty part of the adjunct experience is tying the Twilight Zone sound to it.
Yeah. So, you know, The Professor Is In has been very, very responsive to the scandal of adjunctification since we started in 2011 and has just gotten more so as the years have passed. Basically, we are trying to talk to adjuncts about the choices mm-hmm. that you're making. Mm-hmm. We're also trying to talk to tenure line and tenured colleagues about the choices you're making yeah. with regard to how you're treating your adjunct colleagues. We're trying to talk to administrators about why are you so dependent on adjunct labor. And we're also just trying to really publicize the real scope of the scandal of adjunctification. I start all of my live events on the academic job market with a few basic facts and figures, and they appear to come as a shock to virtually every audience I talk to. And to me in 2020 or 2019 or whenever it was, it's shocking to me that these figures are still a shock. So I'm going to go through them right now for yeah. you.
And that's a good idea.
They aren't updated necessarily for the last year or so, but you can assume, because I do follow it pretty closely in terms of the Chronicle and new data, that anything I'm saying has not improved. It has not improved. It has actually gotten worse in the last couple of years. So the upshot is that since the 1970s, staffing of universities has reversed itself from being 75% tenure line and tenured faculty members and about 25% adjuncts and contingent instructors to now being about 75% contingent faculty members and only lower than 25% who are tenure track or tenured. So this is all because of a shift, a basic defunding of higher ed, and also a kind of neoliberal corporatization where even those institutions that aren't confronting budget crises, like the Ivy Leagues and so on, have just gone with the flow and have also replaced their faculty, the majority of their faculty, with people who are contingent in some form or another. And I do just one last figure I want to say. There are different kinds of contingent faculty, and we will talk about that. But right now, those who are adjuncts specifically, which means people who are hired on a one-off course-by-course basis, paid a lump sum and not given any benefits or anything else in addition, 25% of those people, adjuncts specifically, live below the U.S. poverty line and qualify for welfare mm-hmm. and public assistance.
Yeah. I think we also have to put in there, and it sort of ties in, maybe it's just repetitive of what you were saying, is that along with that defunding, right, the state's defunding was in some ways a result of or was tied into an increasing demand for a specific outcome of a college education. So as a college education moved more toward how is this going to make you have a job mm-hmm. instead of how are we going to think better, be blown away, change our views, then it became much more of a, look, we have to hire people who are going to train people so the people who are paying for their educations are happy with it, or the people who are going into debt are feeling like they're going to get something out of it. It was also the sort of dismantling of the appreciation of an intellectual.
Oh, right. Of the sort of core educational mission.
Right.
It becomes very instrumentalized. Right. It's like, well, these are deliverables,
right,
which is certain class content. And frankly, anyone can do it. And in fact, computers could do it. And that's a shift to online education, you know, or MOOCs or, you know, massive online courses or whatever. It's just put somebody in front of you and deliver you a bunch of stuff into your brains and take your money and call it good. And not at all about a kind of a cultivation of expertise and curiosity and a long-term investment and particularly challenging ideas that might upset the status quo, which is, of course, what tenure was originally meant to protect. And it's why you had the tenure track and then tenure. And there's just a complete disinvestment in that idea.
Right. I mean, when you and I were in college, it was sort of expected that you were going to go off to college and fill your head with shit that was going to piss your parents off. Mm-hmm. And then you were going to go home and tell them how backward and not thinking about this or that they were.
How blighted.
Right. And that seems to have been moved over into an elite group of slacks. Like we're going to have a critical conversation here. And now if you're at a giant R1, you're going to be in a class, a geology class, 101 geology, it's going to be 300 students if you're lucky.
Or 600 or 800.
Right. And there's not going to be any deeper discussion. Mm-hmm. We're just going to train you that this is this rock, that's that rock, and that's mm-hmm. that rock.
And by the way, I just want to say that I don't think the current faculty members believe that.
No.
It's the administrators and the politicians who, the state legislatures, who are deciding the worth of higher education in their states, and the corporate leaders who are increasingly put on the boards of directors of universities, and the boards of regents and so on, who are making these decisions about the value of intellectual work that are based on a corporate neoliberal logic. Faculty, generally speaking, I think even to this day, outside of perhaps business schools, are fighting the good fight for what we do, but they've massively lost power.
Well, I think, you know, in talking to even management and business and PhDs in the work I do with interview interventions, they're thinking about like social questions and, and I mean, they're thinking difficult questions. Mm-hmm. So, but I think the push has been so much in the other direction, and especially around funding, because you're having to go get funding now.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and also, I mean, I just want to say, I don't want to also blame the undergraduate students who increasingly come to college saying, what kind of a starting salary can I expect as a result of this investment? Because the investment is outrageous. It's $75,000 a year at most of the higher level universities right now. And even the lower level ones are probably 40. Something like that. And so people are going into a huge amount of debt. That's a different topic for another day. But they do need to see an ROI, return on investment, for this investment. And so I can see why they're increasingly risk averse as the students and their families. So the whole thing boils down to a larger macroeconomic disinvestment in a retraction of funding of higher ed at all levels and what the university really originally meant. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to say originally because that's kind of nativist and I don't know what.
Well, at least the myth that they put out.
Yeah.
There was a point at which the myth was you're going to go to college to expand your mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that that was the goal. I can remember as a working class kid coming from with conservative relatives who were very, very concerned about what was going to happen to my brain when I went to college.
Right.
It was like, you're going to go there and the devil's going to get you.
Yeah.
And I think now it's go to college and figure out how to make more money.
And major in accounting and,
you
know, have something to tell your parents that you're going to be guaranteed a job at the end of it. And anyhow.
Not to say that I don't think that there's a whole swath of evangelicals out there saying.
Absolutely.
The devil will get you. But anyway, so
that's
let's go
the
on
context
to
of where we are. So the trouble is that the enrollment in PhD programs has not declined over the 40 years that tenure track hiring has declined. On the contrary, enrollment in PhD programs has skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. And there are a whole bunch of reasons for that. And some of them have to do with the same economic anxieties that we've just been talking about, that people can't get stable jobs and can't envision their futures. And so they say, well, I'll go to grad school. In fact, we were just having a conversation with a young person who said something just like that. And that was just yesterday. So we get it. But the point is people enroll in PhD programs. They might go significantly further into debt to do them. And then they come out at the end and nobody has told them the truth that hiring has been absolutely decimated. And right now, only between 5 and 30% of PhDs in every field across the board, there may be one or two exceptions that truly are exceptions that prove the rule. Only between 5 and 30% of PhDs will ever get a tenure track job offer, even just one. And so that means the majority of PhDs, the vast majority in some fields, 95%, are not ever going to get a tenure track offer and are going to have to do something else and not have that particular dream fulfilled. Now, what people end up doing frequently, especially in the humanities, is they adjunct because that gives you the chance to keep the dream alive,
right,
that you're going to stay on campus. You're going to keep teaching those students, keep teaching in your field, keep walking on those lovely, the lovely quad in the fall with changing leaves and the ivy covered buildings. You know, I get it. It's very, very hard to give that up.
I also think there's another reason that people, I think that people begin to adjunct because they want to stay in it. I also think that there's a whole contingent of people for whom adjuncting is a slippery slope, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're in graduate school and for whatever reason, they've been put in charge of a course. And there are departments that have graduate students teaching the full course. There aren't a lot of them, but it does happen. So you've taught the course or you've been the TA on the course and then you've been given the course suddenly, maybe right after you graduate and you kind of don't have a plan. So you're there.
Right.
And then
you're good. Because you didn't get a tenure track job offer. So you need to do something.
Or you're not even on the market yet. I'm just saying like for me, I remember why I got my first adjuncting job because I was walking down the hall. I was talking to the dean and he happened to be a grammar expert. And he mentioned the grammar for journalist class. And I said, oh, that's a class I'd love to teach. Now, I can guarantee that there was probably no one else in the building who would say that sentence.
Right.
Who's going to say, I would love to teach 300 freshmen about grammar. So I got handed that job like mm-hmm. a hot potato. Here,
right.
You take it.
Right.
And then you're in, right? Mm-hmm. And then they say, well, do you want to take on this other right. massive, incredibly difficult, mm-hmm. nobody wants to teach it class? Sure.
And you feel valued.
You feel
recognized.
Right. And you're doing something. And I had the good fortune of starting as an adjunct with a per class cost for a couple semesters, I think it was. And I was still doing other things and then getting a visiting professor position. So I was being paid mm-hmm. a reasonable wage, which is, there's a difference in contingent faculty. Anyway.
Yeah.
I just think that sometimes it's mm-hmm. the slope. It's not
it
just
is.
Like, oh,
sure.
You run over to a different university. It's at your own university
yeah,
that you slide into.
Of course. I mean, I think there's many, many paths to adjuncting, including sometimes people have family situations where they had to join their spouse in a city that, you know, they didn't choose on their own. And they have to come up with some way to patch together something that looks like the career they wanted. And adjuncting at local universities is the way to do it. There's not just one route to it. But the point is so many of us end up there. And so many people have written about this that it's not really necessary for us. If you do a Google search of Quitlet, you will find about 1,000 adjunct stories of people written by people who adjuncted and then gave up and left with great bitterness. But it's some very good writing, I must say. And a lot of them articulate a thing. It's like being the child looking in the window of a mansion with, you know, the chandeliers and the sparkling wine glasses and the well-dressed people. And you're just perennially outside looking in. You're so darn close, but you're not inside. And mm-hmm. I think that is something that happens. Again, you don't want to just stop. Oh, and then there's the fact that, and this is true of you as well, I know, you might be an award-winning teacher.
Right.
Your students love you, and you know if you don't teach this class, it either won't be taught at all or it won't be well taught, and who's going to suffer? The students.
Right, and you get way too cathected onto the students mm-hmm. and their experience of it. But you're also rescuing, well, that's a digression, but in that mentality of, I have to do this for the students, because the university or the department isn't taking care of them, you're actually rescuing and enabling a really dysfunctional situation if they're not managing to care for those students. But that's a whole other digression into where we don't set boundaries around student working with students. But I do think, you know, there's a lot of really amazing, amazing people out there adjuncting mm-hmm. who are fantastic teachers, who transform the lives of students. Mm-hmm. I talk to them all the time and they are really amazing. This is going to be a controversial take, and go ahead and at me, I guess, at Kel Weinhold on Twitter. But so fucking what?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you, at some point, You have to take care of you.
You do. Because nobody's going to take care of you, and the institution sure isn't.
This institution will eat you alive.
Mm-hmm. If you have worked for pennies for 3 years, why would they stop employing you for pennies? Why? What motivation do they possibly have to change this arrangement that you have allowed to exist?
And then I watch people who, on the other side of it, like, you know, they'll suddenly create a tenure track job, right? So create a tenure track job in the same area you've been being an adjunct forever, and you've been the best one. And,
oh, sure.
And you apply for the job. You aren't even on the short list.
Oh, no.
And I have watched people leave in such pain and bitterness of, how could you do this to me?
Oh, yeah.
And the realistic part of me thinks, because you're not
new and shiny.
Well, you're not new and shiny, but you also, you don't have articles. You don't have anything.
Right.
You've been devoting your entire life to this. You're no longer.
Right. It's apples and oranges.
It's apples and oranges.
So it's, and of course there we have our saying, familiarity breeds contempt.
Yeah, right.
I mean, not, you know, sorry. I know we try to steer clear of cynicism and bitterness because it's very corrosive and damaging.
Mm-hmm.
It's not constructive. It really isn't. You will pass through a bitter stage. Mm-hmm. I actually think a stage of bitterness is fairly healthy, honestly. And because you have to confront what has happened on the both the macro and micro levels. But they are not in about, I mean, I'm going to say like 95% of cases, they're not going to see you as a legitimate tenure track candidate. Now, you are probably, a lot of you listening are going to say, but I know this one case.
Yeah.
So do I. So do we. We know some cases of adjuncts who did get, when they opened the tenure track line, that they did get through. But oh my gosh, it is as rare as hen's teeth.
And I feel like the places it's not rare are places that are so specialized. I see it happen in the arts sometimes, right? So people who are in the fine arts and they've been teaching courses in the fine arts, and a position opens up and they have a long career in their own work and been teaching. And then the position opens up where they've been an adjunct. And I see people get those jobs because they're such the perfect fit. But if you are one of the zillion people who can teach English comp.
Right.
And they're going to hire somebody for an English position in 18th century literature. They're going to pick the shiny new PhD who has a couple publications in the funnel.
In the high ranking journals.
Right.
And you didn't have time to write because you were so busy adjuncting.
Right. And your 15 terms of teaching, you know, rhetorical comp are just not going to fly.
Right.
I always feel bad when we talk about this because I feel like sometimes it gets heard as is we don't respect what you're doing. That's not the case at all.
My experience is, I don't know why.
Because you're just making it up, but go ahead.
But I don't,
my
experience, I don't feel
which
like,
is just a thought in my
just
head.
Just self-serving. delusion is that I don't think people think I think that they can hear the respect in our voices for what they do. Honestly, I think people can hear the love that we have for what the Academy could be, but also our absolute determination to shine a light on what it isn't and how it doesn't tell the truth about that. So this is truth telling, and I feel really committed to it. And I think truth telling in this is a kind of tough love, and I'm really committed to it. But I just want to go through some basics here, just to remind you, in the vein of tough love, that adjuncting is bad, generally speaking. And again, some of you are going to come back and say, oh, but I have a partner who's a corporate attorney. And so, you know, I just do it kind of for fun to keep my hand in the game. And I'm like, okay, fine. You know, some of you have financial cushion. Some of you have privilege. Some of you are single parents with children who have a health issue and have no backup and are ending up sleeping on your parents' sofa or in the basement. You're confronting very different circumstances. So I'm going to say adjuncting is bad, knowing that it's not bad in the same way for everybody. It's bad in different ways for different people at different levels. But let me just walk you through some of the specifics. They don't pay you adequately. Some folks, a lot of folks on Twitter, if you can Google this, have done crowdsourced surveys of what adjuncts are paid. And they are paid, so they started about $1,800 for a 10 or 16 week course. I mean, there is very, very clear scholarship out there that shows that the majority of adjuncting wages, when you break it down to the hourly wage, is lower than Walmart. It is lower than Walmart by the time you put in your class prep and your office hours and your actual and the lecturing and so on. Now, some wages go up to $3,000 or $5,000. Some of the elite places may be more like $6,000. But if you actually put in the hours you put in teaching this class, prepping it and meeting with students and grading, then none of the hourly wages are actually really defensible. Then there's the issue of the kind of disrespect that you experience from your tenure line colleagues and the administrators and possibly the students, although generally students don't really understand who's a adjunct and who isn't. It's mostly from your colleagues.
I just want to pause a minute in that, so why it's bad. I want to point out why that treatment by those tenure track colleagues actually becomes a thing that keeps you in the adjuncting game.
Hmm.
Because you're doing this thing that you are devoting yourself to, especially the people who are really love teaching and they're really devoted and they do that teaching, and those tenure track faculty disrespect that teaching. And instead of saying, this is not a healthy situation for me, I need to do something else, you think, I'll prove to you. Mm-hmm. I can prove to you. I remember those moments in my teaching career. I remember being at one point as a visiting professor, being in charge of the two largest classes in the department. I carried more FTE as an individual than everybody else in the department, and being in a faculty meeting and having a senior male call me a teaching drone.
Mm.
And what should have resulted in my leaving and going to get a different job, because mm-hmm. what an environment to put myself in, was just rage and double down. Mm-hmm. So I think that bad treatment mm-hmm. in a way is one of the yeah. things that feeds our continuing to try to do mm-hmm. it, to prove, mm-hmm. I'm just as good as you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that.
Yeah. Anyway, I just had to.
Yeah, no, that's a great story, actually. Yeah. And at the same time, the harm that it's doing to your psyche as you just keep staying in there.
Right.
Semester after semester.
Right.
But so then there's the obvious things, the exhaustion and the fatigue of, because to make a living as an adjunct, you have to teach at multiple places, which means being a freeway flyer, driving up and down, hours of commute, rushing from campus to campus. So, there's just the sheer logistical exhaustion of it. And then, of course, the economic insecurity, not just that you're paid badly, as you already know, but that you don't know if you're going to be paid at all the next semester, because you don't know if you're going to be given a class or not, or you're given a class, but it's under enrolled and then it's canceled.
Right before it starts.
Right.
We know plenty of people who have been counting on their $2,200 or their $3,000. Mm-hmm. And the week before, they don't have a class.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at the Professor's Inn, we have a job seeker support fund that people can qualify for if they've been confronting certain sets of circumstances. And one of them is you had a class canceled
right.
that you were counting on.
And you need help with your job docs, and we have support for that.
So, yeah. But like you were just saying a moment ago, in some ways the labor, so this is going to another reason adjuncting is bad, is because although you feel like you're rescuing the system
mm-hmm.
and the students, what you're doing is you're perpetuating the exploitation.
Right.
The exploitative system.
Right. And, this is, to me, it's going to take a unified effort, because it's a little bit like union busting,
mm-hmm.
right? If everybody who was an adjunct right now put down their red pens and said, put down their little laser pens and said, I'm not stepping in front of this classroom.
Put
down your pens and walk out. If every single adjunct at every single university today said, we're walking out, and formed a picket line around universities, the situation is desperate enough, and people are so addicted to the idea of being in the academy and their dream of being a mm-hmm. professor, that it would be hard pressed to keep scabs from going right across and saying, mm-hmm. I'll teach it.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it happen all the time. Mm-hmm. We see people, adjuncts lose jobs all the time, and somebody else go, I'll teach it.
Yeah.
Oh, they cut the price, so they cut the thing, so I'm not going to do it.
And part of the problem is a structural system of graduate training mm-hmm. is that every single year there's a new cohort that comes out, 60,000 PhDs in the United States every single year, and every year there is a new set of 60,000 people who are stunned and shocked that there is a bad job market, and stunned and shocked that their tenure track applications didn't yield an offer. Well, let's say not 60,000. Let's say there's 60,000 PhD. There's 50,000 people who are shocked. 10,000 who are like, oh, good, I have a job. The other 50,000 are laundering around in the wilderness. And then they're like, well, I don't know what to do. So I guess I'll just, there's this adjunct position. I guess I'll just do that.
But with that, I just want to say something because I don't think we've said this actually in a declarative statement. And I want to make sure that right here in the middle of this podcast, we say it and we say it again. Adjuncting will not, is not, cannot be seen as a path to a tenure track job.
Mm-hmm.
If you are telling yourself that you are teaching to improve your chances of getting a tenure track job, you're telling a lie to yourself. You are following a myth.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just make that really clear.
Yep. And I'm going to talk about that in a second with some actual concrete job market advice. But I know that you, with your work with Unstuck and productivity and so on, you talk about false narratives.
Mm-hmm.
And sunk cost fallacy, which is, well, I put all this money and time into getting a PhD. I better use it come hell or high water.
Right.
So if adjuncting is the only way I can use it, I had better use it, even though actually it's, as isn't it your mom who always says, putting good money after bad?
Yeah. Spending good time after bad money.
Oh, that too.
Mm-hmm. And your adjuncting is good time. Mm-hmm. There are other things you can be doing with that time.
Well, sure.
And you're just putting yourself further and back in your lifetime wage, right? If you're thinking about ever catching up and you say, okay, well, for these 16 weeks, I'm going to make this amount of money. I mean, it might be a move up for you. And I also think that that's what happens is like, this is more money than I've ever been paid. It's
wow,
the
how as an adjunct?
I think we want to be really careful about what people's wage potential was going into the PhD.
Yeah, sure.
I think there are a lot of people, I mean, we know, and statistics bear out that in times of economic pressure and stress, the applications to graduate school go up because people are trying to improve their chances of having employment. Mm-hmm. So we don't know what the economic chance was. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've talked to any number of people who we have helped get jobs. In fact, we talked to one just recently who said, your help got me a job that changed my class.
Sure.
So I think we just have to, we don't know.
Right. No, I was not actually taking issue with that so much as I am not really familiar with many adjunct payment scales that, well, frankly, that are just adequate, that people can live on.
Right. Yeah.
And I know there are exceptions, and I do know, and again, let's just reiterate, just for the sake of any, you know, people who are having a fight with us in your car or whatever, that I am talking about adjuncts. I'm not talking about contingent, like non-tenure track continuing contracts,
which
sometimes are really well paid. I'm not talking about all that. I'm talking about the one-off courses with a lump sum of $3,000 or $5,000, especially when you have dependents, especially when you're living in one of those urban centers where so many universities are centered, like Boston or the Bay Area or Los Angeles or New York City or Chicago. This pay level is not actually livable. And oftentimes you're increasing your debt load as you pursue it. But that's also about acknowledging the truth of what you said too, that not knowing where people are coming from, not making assumptions about that.
Right.
Anyway, so all of those things, reasons that adjuncting is bad, and also all the reasons that adjuncting is so tempting. We've gone through all that. So you have to just think of it as a stopgap. It is a strategic move that you can make in a very, very strategic and considered and methodical way for a very short amount of time. But what you want to make sure that it doesn't do is feed into that thing we've talked about in our other podcasts, which is the external validation dependency of academia. Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, this idea that if I keep doing this, you're going to approve of me and take me and keep me is, I think behind a lot of it. And I also, let me just pause here because we're talking about something really hard. And the really hard idea is giving up a dream,
mm-hmm.
right? I went into graduate school because I have dreamed since I was 8 years old that I wanted to be a professor. I went into graduate school because I had an amazing professor when I was in high school and I wanted to have that, or in college, and I wanted to have that impact. Mm-hmm. I went into graduate school because I love fungi and I wanted to study them, everything about them. And I wanted to have a university job where I could study them. And I wanted to have a lab where I could look at them.
Microscopes.
I have microscopes. And this was, I dreamed of this.
I want to go to graduate school because I discovered dusty university libraries at some point, and this is actually my story, growing up in Pittsburgh and Carnegie Library and Carnegie Mellon and Pitt, and going and wandering in those libraries and saying, you mean I could get paid to hang out here? Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. Introvert self that I, little self that I was.
Yeah. So there's a hope and a dream that you did. We were talking to this kid yesterday who was like, you know, and I'm thinking about academia, and neither of our expressions changed because I was watching Karen and we were just like, and I could just see that whole thing. He's super smart. He loves ideas. He loves to be around smart people. You know, if it was really what he imagined, it would be great. But it's anyway, so there's all that. So to give that up, to stop adjuncting means to give that up. In some ways, it doesn't mean the end, but it does mean that give that part up. And I just want to acknowledge it's really hard.
It's hard.
It's really hard and it's painful and it requires grieving.
It does.
Grieving in a real way.
I'm glad you said that because, yeah, it requires grieving. Mm. And I want you to grieve. I do. If this is speaking to you right now, I want you to feel sad. I want you to stop now and mourn what the university has become after almost 50 years of assault in the United States and globally to a large degree in terms of just an anti-intellectual transformation of society, a retrenchment, a disbelief in expertise, and that has accelerated under Trump. And, you know, it is sad and it deserves to be grieved. And you, if you are a PhD who believed one thing and has now discovered it, the truth, it is good for you to grieve. Because honestly, if you keep suppressing it, and this is, again, very consistent with our message in so many realms in the podcast, if you suppress these emotional truths, you will make not optimal decisions about your professional life and your personal life and the way those intersect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, but to get to the concrete advice, in terms of your cover letter, so we are going to talk about strategizing adjuncting itself, but before I forget, I just want to make sure you know that I have this advice in my book in chapter 10, the second half of chapter 10, so check it out. But basically, if you have a cover letter or a teaching statement, you don't want to write a when and where story, chronological narrative of adjuncting. You know, in fall of 2018, I adjuncted at the University of New Hampshire in the class, blah, blah, blah. And then in spring of 2019, I adjuncted at University of Massachusetts teaching the class, blah, blah, blah. Those things are completely irrelevant. And the reason is because nobody cares where you taught these other courses. Nobody who's on a search committee at the University of Arizona cares that you were at Massachusetts or New Hampshire, what you were doing in 2018, 2019. What they care about is what you teach and how you teach it in a way that can be translated to University of Arizona. So you're going to say, at the University of Arizona, I would be prepared to teach the intro to cell biology. And when I teach that intro course, I emphasize this and I use this textbook and I do it this way and I have students do these things. So you convert it from past tense to present tense. I mean this literally. Convert your narrative from past to present tense and just tell them what you teach and how you teach it.
And locate it where you're applying.
Yeah, where you're applying to, not some story of 2 years ago or the past. The past is dead.
Right, and you talk about that a lot in prepping documents and just talking in general, is that search committees are interested in your future.
Yeah.
Their risk is your future. So your past can, in some cases, alleviate their fear because it can show that you have a track record. But you use that in the present to talk about the future.
About the future, yeah. Right. And the same is true in interviews, I assume.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to be wasting interview time telling University of Arizona Search Committee what you did at University of New Hampshire 2 years ago.
Well, it's just like in the structure of the teaching answer. We don't say, when I taught, we say, when I teach cell biology, my goal is that, not when I taught it.
Right.
They're always saying in the present, I do this.
Yeah. Yeah. So remember that. So in terms of adjuncting itself, let's go back to our point. Approach it strategically. Mm-hmm. You have a specific course at a specific place and a specific time period that you're willing to invest, and you have calculated that as not throwing you into financial catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that one of the things that I do with Unstuck, which is our productivity program, is that the first core value of the program is honesty, tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And you cannot tell the truth unless you look things straight in the eye. So you have to start looking at what you're saying about adjuncting, but also about what the consequences of adjuncting are. And then asking the question, how long am I going to do this? Mm-hmm. How long is it reasonable for me to do this? Because, man, do I understand. You get on a treadmill and you just stay on the treadmill because the treadmill's moving. So sure, I'll teach a class next term. Sure, I'll teach a class next term. I mean, there must be something about human beings evolutionarily that we'll just like stay in a rut.
Well, I understand it. I mean, right now you and I are looking at the professors in our business, which has been running along, very nicely for about a decade, and looking at all these innovations we could be making. Mm-hmm. And I am confronting how hard it is for me to make these innovations because I have a routine. I'm used to editing documents. I'm used to running webinars. I'm used to a certain pattern of my days, weeks, months, and years. And it's actually really hard to stop doing something and to substitute something else for that. And it's hard to recognize that substitution should happen and it should happen now.
Right. Actually, this relates to a webinar that I do that if you are a member of the Himalaya Plus, the premier membership program that we have for the professors in, you can listen to this podcast. But I talk about the difficulty of making change. And I do a whole webinar on it's actually the liminal state between that we're terrifies us.
So are you saying that this is a webinar that's going to be available for our members?
Yeah. So you'll be able to get that webinar so you can really understand why it's hard to leave adjuncting because it's not the unimagined future that scares you. It's the in-between when you don't know what the hell. And that's sort of wired into us. And it's a whole webinar on how to manage that liminal state.
Right.
But anyway,
that's great.
I digress.
Yeah. Just a note that if you become a member of the Professors in Plus on the Himalaya podcast platform, you will have access to that webinar and to a lot of other stuff like my 7-day CV reboot and members only podcast episodes as well. And things that we're still discussing as we move forward, because this is all new to us as well. So anyway, all right. So
the thing is that if you're an adjunct, the first question that you have to ask yourself is the first thing that you have to do when you go into adjuncting is set your end date for adjuncting. Mm-hmm. It's just like setting a deadline for an article. Mm. Don't start without knowing when you're going to finish. There's a little side productivity coaching note there. Always set your deadline before you start so you know where you're going. But no, set a specific time. Like Karen said, a specific time, a specific thing you're willing to do, specific classes that you are willing to teach. And don't let it sort of start to attach to you like barnacles and you're just dragging your barnacle covered self from university to university because somebody said, Will you teach this?
So Katie Rose Guest Priall, who has written many, many excellent columns in the Chronicle on her post-academic transition, has one that was called One Adjunct's 5-Point Manifesto. And I love it. And I want you all to write your own manifestos. And basically it's, and I'm not going to quote this perfectly, but if you Google it, you'll find it. But it's her manifesto was, I'm going to live in the location, geographical location that I love near people I love. Mm-hmm. That's actually in the academy. That's planting a flag.
That's radical.
Yeah. And she has some other points, which I'm now forgetting, but I wanted to get to the fifth point, which is, I will not go back, even if they ask me. And that's radical.
Yeah.
Because you know what? You're going to make this great decision and you're going to say, that's it. Karen and Kel inspired me. I'm going to do this thing. I'm not going to do it anymore. And then 2 weeks from now, you're going to get a phone call that says, hey, we have a course. Somebody's going on medical leave. You can teach this course. The student, and they're going to flatter you. Oh, you know, the students love you. Oh, you're the best person. Oh, we just appreciate you so much. And what is going to happen? You're going to get sucked back in. And this is where the rubber hits the road, where you have to have that sense of yourself, your boundaries, and your well-being, that you are not going to martyr yourself again in the pursuit of a dream.
So here's the wrap-up for you. If you are considering adjuncting or you are an adjunct, the first question that I want you to ask yourself is, does it work for you in all the categories that matter to you? So sometimes that may mean sitting down and writing down what matters, where I live matters, how much I drive matters, what time of day it is matters. I don't care what matters. So then you can ask yourself what works for you. Because what happens is we can get our attention too far on what works for them and forget ourselves. So ask that question. And if it's not working for you, you are sacrificing your present for an imagined future.
Right.
You're not, as long as you're in the present that you want, great. But if you are in a present that you are doing for an imagined future, you are sacrificing yourself for a fiction. Not because I'm saying it'll never happen, but because anything we imagine in the future is a fiction. Anything we make up is made up because we have no way of seeing it. So does it work right now for you? And if it doesn't, time to do something else.
And let me just put a flag up about the gender aspect of and the martyrdom aspect, because you had just said a moment ago, does this work? You're too focused on, does this work for them? And I was thinking about, who is the them? It's easy to get pretty harsh with the institution. It's pretty easy to get harsh with the department, but it is hard to get that level of harsh boundaries with the students, because the students look vulnerable. And they are vulnerable, but you have to have those boundaries with the students as well. So if your rationale starts with, but the students need, then that's no more morally better, or it might seem morally better, but it is not in fact better than any of the other calculations you make. It doesn't, you aren't going to be better off in your life if you martyr yourself for these students. And women are exponentially more likely to do this, although by no means are men immune to this. But the adjuncts who have been adjuncting for year after year, decade after decade, with no retirement savings and no security and financially precarious, the among the, that population, women are the absolute majority. And so it really, there is this moral calculation that women in particular make, that I'm a better person if I sacrifice myself for others. And I really just want to put up a giant stop sign.
And I also want to just point out, I'm going to call out white women on this in particular, that I think that this is a real, we see this as a real tendency among white women. And that for everybody, I really want to point out that doing this, maintaining this exploitive system, all of this is enabling a patriarchal white supremacist system. It is
capitalist.
It is. You are enabling it.
Yeah. So just wrapping up, I don't want to let the tenure track colleagues and administrators off the hook either. There are things you can do. I know that the narrative is generally that you feel powerless and that it's larger economic forces and evil administrators who are making these decisions. But there are things you can do, as simple as make eye contact with your adjunct colleagues. Don't look away. Don't avoid making eye contact with them. Maybe even go a step further. Say hello.
Treat them like adjunct
colleagues. How they're doing. Ask them what they're working on. Ask them what they're writing. They're scholars as well. Treat them, like Kel said, treat them like colleagues. And then, of course, beyond that, if you can administratively incorporate them in ways that are not furthering exploitation, and this is a gray area and a fine line, so note about that. But if you can invite them into community, your department community or your campus community in ways that don't increase their labor, but do increase their opportunities, please do that. And if you see your colleagues not doing it, tell your colleagues to do it. And if you see your department head making choices that aren't optimal, talk to your department head. And if you are a department head, talk to the dean when you have a chance to really, to the degree possible in your institution, deal with the reality of adjunct exploitation.
Yeah. I mean, on every level, fight for faculty unions.
Mm-hmm.
Fight for faculty unions that include adjuncts.
You.
Fight for faculty, yeah. Fight for unions for graduate fellows. I mean, mm-hmm. Fight for unions.
Unionization.
Act like you're a freaking member of the proletariat, because you are.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. That's essential.
I mean, I just think that this sort of stuff of like, well, you know, you're an adjunct and I'm a tenured faculty is tenured faculty still believing that they're in some way management,
mm-hmm.
and that they're not just part of the worker class of the university.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, isn't it?
And it's just like, seriously,
mm-hmm.
get a grip,
mm-hmm.
and get to work.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're an adjunct,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't work for you.
Get an exit plan and make sure that you are using some creating time in your schedule to do career development work that is both focused on tenure track job market, like getting writing done, going to conferences and so on, and more importantly, remembering that the majority of PhDs do not get a tenure track job, the post-ACT, non-ACT, what I call real ACT job market prep of just thinking about the other kinds of work that you can do outside the academy, outside the classic tenure track, and laying the groundwork to be able to move into that moving forward.
Absolutely. So spend as much time taking care of your own career and your mm-hmm. own job development as you do grading papers. How's
yeah.
that for a challenge?
Mm-hmm.
So we look forward to seeing you next Tuesday when the next episode drops. Take care.
Bye.